You are now listening to the Good Morning Show on WBOK 1230 AM.
We're back. Welcome back to the Good Morning Show. Oliver O.T. Thomas, the early bird in time. WBOK listening audience, man, I want to thank all of our callers and all of our listeners, man. And if you want to weigh in, but you don't want to call in, some people really don't like to hear their own voice. It's like a lot of folks don't like to see themselves on television. We got a lot of camera and media hogs today. But there's some folk who don't like to see themselves or hear themselves. You can call a WBOK text line at 318-599-9265. 318-599-9265. And let us know what you think and how you feel. All of your opinions are valued. I actually think they help make us a better show, a better audience, and a better community when we share how we feel. And also, if the topics that you think we ought to talk about, call in and recommend them on the text line. But right now, we're continuing our series on unprisoned stories from the system, which have been very captivating. I'd like to say unbelievable, because they really talk about the weakness, you know, and how unjust our system is, but believable because it's what we live every day. In the studio, Ms. Katie Rechtal. Katie, how you doing?
All right. How you doing?
If I was any better, I'd be you. That's my line. And Mr. Bruce Riley, the Deputy Director of Vote Void of the Ex-Offender. Of course, we all know who Norris Henderson is, but this is one of the pieces of the glue that hold Norris and that organization together. Mr. Bruce Riley, thank you for coming to the Good Morning Show.
Good morning.
I know we got a clip we're going to open up with. Another unbelievable, believable clip about the system. Unprisoned, stories from the system. Go ahead and play the clip.
Democrat John Bel Edwards is Louisiana's new governor. That's partly because more voters than expected cast ballots in Saturday's election. Some go to greater lengths than others to vote, including some current and former inmates. Louisiana, unlike many of its Deep South neighbors, restores voting rights to citizens with felony convictions after they've served their time. But some people who served their time are still left out.
In prison, I was what they call a jailhouse lawyer. I studied law. That's all I'd done.
This is Calvin Duncan.
I'm 52 years old. I was wrongfully convicted, sent to prison for 28 and a half years for a crime I didn't commit. And when I was released in 2011 by the hard work of the Innocent Project, I wanted to be able to vote, to enjoy the most fundamental right that I think all Americans enjoyed.
Within 72 hours of his release, Duncan went to City Hall and registered to vote. But it was while serving time in Angola that he came to appreciate the full value of this right. Duncan was part of a group called the Angola Special Civics Project.
It's an organization that guys in prison would contact their families and say, look, mom, dad, you got to register to vote. You got to go vote because you have to help us change our circumstances.
Duncan would call his aunt. She'd given up voting because, like many people, she was frustrated with politicians and had lost faith in the system. But Duncan changed that.
Because she would contact me, Calvin, you know, they got this guy running for office. Who you think we should vote for? I would say, well, don't vote for that judge, because that judge is using her position to be tough on crime, which is not her job. You know, vote for this person, because this person is saying we're going to take people that accuse of crime and develop programs.
Now Duncan gets to make those decisions himself. A 1974 provision in the Louisiana Constitution says once convicted felons have served their time, whether in prison, probation, or on parole, they can vote.
I'm not voiceless anymore. I have the greatest power that you could have in this country.
Every inmate gets an inmate orientation form, and a section of that form is dedicated to inmate voting.
Captain William Devlin runs the inmate voting program at the New Parish Jail, which mostly holds people awaiting trial. Devlin ran inmate voting at the old jail, OPP, too.
The very first thing that happens is we send out a form to the tiers saying, okay, you have an election coming up on such and such a date. Do you want to vote?
Devlin looks over the list of inmates interested in voting. Those in jail awaiting trial, who aren't under order of imprisonment, confinement, probation, or parole, they're eligible. Devlin sends the list with his notes to the registrar, which, after a rather involved process, gets absentee ballots to inmates who qualify. The new jail is quiet and industrial. We take an elevator up to security, then another elevator up to the floor where two inmates in orange jumpsuits have been brought from their pods. Out of close to 1,600 inmates, 49 requested to vote in the runoff election for governor, 8 qualified. Inside a small multi-purpose room, Deputy Jean Law opens the ballots for two of the inmates and hands them pens.
That's your instructions. Yes, so need.
There's one in here and one here?
Yes. One in every category. You got governor, lieutenant governor, and attorney general.
Both inmates have voted before. One of them, Jerome, says,
my first time voting in jail.
The other, Jonathan, has been inside since March and has voted in every election since then. He says it's a right Americans take for granted.
And, yeah, guys, okay, yeah, that was one of the most glaring Mr. Riley and Katie about that clip is that 1,600 inmates, 49 requested, but only 8 were able to vote. Talk about why, because when I talk to people, you know, who deal with this issue around the country, you know, there's still millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people who've been through the system who should be able to vote, but even though they say they can, still have not cast their vote. Why?
Well, I think one of the challenges with jail-based voting is that people are there for a short period of time, and so you're going to miss a lot of folks, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have to be there at the right time to request the ballot and then mm-hmm. still be there when the election comes. And I think a lot of people are probably not anticipating that it may take 30, 60, 90 days mm-hmm. to get bail or clear up their charge.
Right.
So they're not necessarily going to request the ballot. And then about I'm not sure the exact number off the top of my head, but a lot of the folks in there are also in there accused of a probation violation. Mm-hmm. So those would be people who are under order of imprisonment. Mm-hmm. So in the end, like, the amount of people who can end up voting because of the timeline involved is pretty small to begin with. But as you're pointing out, I mean, a lot more people could, I'm sure. Could be instead of 49 people requesting, it probably be a few hundred people requesting.
So this provision in 1974 that was established supposedly in the most incarcerated state, in the country, in the city, in the most incarcerated state in the country that gave us that right. Katie, thousands still don't take advantage of that right. Where's the disconnect? What's the problem?
Well, I mean, you're saying the people who do actually have the right to vote don't
yes,
take advantage.
Absolutely. And there are many who, some of us who've been through that process, we know they qualify, but they still don't think they can, or they still don't.
I've written about this story, this
because I've had a lot of folks I deal with say, man, I can't vote. No, yes, yeah, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can, because I'm voting now, and you've been out longer than me. This is, but they haven't been educated, or they've missed it some kind of way.
Exactly. I think a lot of people think that they can't vote. And
right.
I remember going on the street just to ask people, are you going to vote in this election? I'm writing about people who mm-hmm. can't vote because they have felony convictions or because they're on probation or parole, right? And they said, well, I have a felony conviction from 20 years ago. And I said, well, you know you can vote, right?
Right.
And because so many states around us don't allow people to vote if they have any felony conviction, I think it bleeds into Louisiana.
Now, is it the Mr. Riley? Mm-hmm. Is it the education process? Is there not enough dedicated to informing people of the rights? You know, it's tough enough if you haven't done anything wrong, knowing your rights in America today. But once you become a part of the system, it becomes even more difficult.
Well, I think one of the challenges is, you know, regardless of this issue about people having the right to vote based on a conviction, just our democracy itself is challenged. You know, when half the people are not voting, I mean, that's a serious problem that doesn't just include people who have convictions. And so, you know, one of the challenges is how do you reach people who are not in the voting process, and not just, you know, 17, 18-year-old people who are kind of being asked to enter into it for the first time, but you've got people that are 30, 40, 60 years old who are saying, who am I going to vote for? There's nothing there for me. You know, I don't have any options in this election. And so they're not really seeing voting as something that really impacts their lives. And so a lot of times the struggle is we think about elections so much in terms of presidents, which in a lot of ways is the least impactful part of the electoral process for someone's life. Instead, we should be flipping it around and talking about the local issues and the local elections that are actually going to have a lot more impact on someone's life. I mean, even the people we're talking about in the clip who are in jail, whether you elect one president or another, your life is really not going to be impacted much when you're the person in jail. But there's a lot of other local elections that could have a lot of change in various policies and procedures that could change your entire community.
Well, I think the other issue with people who are disqualified from voting in jail is that you have to vote absentee, right? And you can't vote absentee the first time you vote, right? So if you haven't registered and already voted, then that if you are out of the loop already and then you're in jail and you think, oh, I might try to vote now, it's too late. You can't vote until you get back out and reestablish your voting on the ground.
So that has to be. So now let's talk about, we use Parish Prison as an example. But what about Angola? What about Hunts? What about those other facilities we know that we're going to be for a while? Mm-hmm. What kind of rights do they have? Because we're always asked that.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have no rights.
They have
vote
no rights at all.
No. I mean, the Secretary of State has a list of about 150,000 people mm-hmm. in the state of Louisiana who can't vote. And I'm not sure about the accuracy of their numbers in the sense that the Department of Corrections says we got about 45,000 people who are locked up in prisons or local parishes mm-hmm. who are convicted of a crime. And then there's about 70,000 people who are on probation or parole. Mm-hmm. So then you say, like, well, where's the other, like, 35,000, 40,000 people come from? So I don't really know the exact math, but I do know that they have about 22,000 people on their list for Orleans Parish who are denied the right to
just
vote.
Orleans Parish.
Just Orleans Parish.
Now, that number 70,000, I mean, the eight, I don't know that the eight could necessarily swing on the election, depending on who the eight vote for and how close that particular election is. But the 70,000 could. The 70,000 could make a difference. How many people, if there's studies or estimates, how many people do we think that are on that list that actually can qualify to participate in Louisiana?
It's a good question. You know, I, by the way, on the margins, there was the margin of the 8,000 is greater mm-hmm. than the margin between Nagin and Landrieu.
Right.
The 70,000 margin is greater than the Blanco-Jindal margin.
Right.
So we've got some races that could have been swung,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And that's why I focus on the 70,000. That list could actually begin to make a difference. And when you talk about Mr. Rowley, when you talk about the rights, are ex-offenders, formerly incarcerated citizens, is there a process that actually sits them down to educate them? You know, pre-release is one thing that all prison systems have, but I don't ever remember anybody in pre-release talking about voting. it just doesn't happen. Not with the process I went through or the process others that it'll go through. There's nobody explaining to them how to get your rights back to vote. Should that be mandatory?
Well, they're supposed to be informing people that after they get off probation or parole that they get their voting rights back. Mm-hmm. But that's a relatively new thing, which I can't vouch for mm-hmm. how well that's happening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we're talking about, you know, as Katie is saying, folks that she's been talking to who have older convictions, I mean, once it's been instilled into your mind or instilled into your culture and word on the street, it can be hard to shake that. And mm-hmm. so if we're talking about educating, you know, people just over the last few years who are getting off probation or parole, you know, we've already got tens of thousands of people who have old convictions. I mean, the database in Louisiana has 2.8 million people with convictions. I think some of those are a little bit repetitive, like someone mm-hmm. might be in there three times with three convictions. But you start getting an understanding of historically how big the issue of convictions are in this state, which only has 4.8 million people.
Now, when you talk about so many people in Louisiana, I think that's why we're famous and infamous around the world because of that stat. What are those crimes where you can never have your right back to vote, even if you get your freedom?
I'm trying to remember. Terrorism is one, right? Isn't there one? I'm trying to remember what they are. Mm-hmm. There aren't very many, though. And you know what's interesting? I want to note that our former Secretary of State, Jim Brown, mm-hmm. was not able to vote for a while, even though he used to fly home, take a helicopter home to, was it Faraday he was
yeah.
from? And he would vote to make a big ceremony of him voting, and then suddenly he couldn't vote. And I feel like when you hear somebody who can't vote, I don't know how you felt when you were not able to vote, or Bruce, you're not able to vote.
Felt incomplete.
Yeah.
I felt like I didn't have a sense of citizenship.
That's what I think.
Citizenship is one of the most powerful things that can that's supposed to connect us to this democracy, mm-hmm. and I don't know like that a lot of people understand that. What about this movement throughout the country now to suppress voters, especially ex-offenders, voters of color, marginal communities? How do we deal with that while we're trying to get ex-offenders and formerly incarcerated citizens the right to vote? Because it's kind of going counter to the movement that's actually happening, that's actually trying to limit voting in America. Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's hard to say, oh, by the way, can you open up the vote to more people, especially when the impression is that the people who are going to vote are going to vote more Democrat. That's the problem, mm-hmm. I think, in getting more of the last pass.
Mm-hmm. So is, Republican versus Democrat usually means something in terms of your ability to vote or access to vote. I see the lines are blinking, 504-260-9265. Continue to call in. He's going to pick up the line at some point. Continue to call, 504-260-9265. We're talking to Katie Rechdahl, our editor, and Mr. Bruce Riley, Deputy Director of Vote Voided Ex-Offender. Mr. Riley, with your organization, what's the process that you guys go through when you're sitting down with ex-offenders, men and women, and saying, hey, look, no, you can do this?
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things we do when we're dealing with someone, you know, however we come in contact with somebody who, you know, we consider to be our people, and our people are the friends and families of people mm-hmm. who are in, you know, directly impacted by having been incarcerated and convicted, and entire communities, and we want to make sure that they're registered to vote, that they are voting, because like you said, I mean, it is citizenship, it's one's real stake in the community, and, you know, there's a ceremonial aspect of it, a feeling aspect, but then there's the real power aspect mm-hmm. of it. And so, I mean, just on my street alone, there's about 100 people who are disenfranchised right now. And, you know, whenever I hear the word returning citizen, you know, it's usually said in a respectful way, like, yeah. you know, in a way that's you know, someone is trying to move things forward. And I say, whoa, wait a minute. Like, without voting rights, you're not a citizen.
You're not a citizen.
I'm an internally displaced person.
Right.
And so we've sued the state of Louisiana, Vote versus Louisiana. We filed on July 1st of this year, and the way we read the law and the way several prominent scholars have read and spoken about the law is that it went beyond the Constitution and that people on probation and parole should have the right to vote,
right.
and only people who are incarcerated in prison should be denied the right to vote.
Well, we can go to the lines right now. Thanks for calling in, 504-260-9265. And if you don't want to call in, text us your comments at 318-599-9265. Line one, Brother Douglas, you're on with Mr. Riley and Ms. Katie Rechdahl.
Good morning,
Al. Good morning. Pretty good,
and,
brother.
Incidentally, I want to say to you, the police meeting that you monitored the other night was very good.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, thank you very much. There's a little bit of echo, Brother Douglas, but I can't hear you.
No, I don't. My radio is off.
Okay,
but I don't know what it's going on. But look, here's what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about, you know, watching punishment. Because if we get too involved with punishment, they'll wind up taking the same from punishment. You know, like we have people who victimize our community, and we just can't give them the amount of dignity that they want. We have to reserve some same for people who know what they've done to our community. Now, I don't know who these people are, but I know people will have a tendency, especially gentrifiers, to look for the weaknesses in urban society so they can more or less write a story or try to capitalize on the point. But what I'm trying to say, you know, I feel for former incarcerated people wrongly convicted. I feel for them because it's a horrible thing to happen to them.
Right.
But when we start talking about giving voter rights to everybody that has been convicted, I mean, that's what I look at. Number one, some people who have been incarcerated have very vindictive attitudes. You know, we just can't surrender our political system to that type of mentality, that type of attitude. You know what I'm saying? I'm looking at the fact that we have to look at the fact that let's get to those children and talk to them earlier about, hey, if you decide to go rob somebody,
gotcha.
You just decide to go do something low down to the community, you're going to lose your right to vote. So I'm saying, it's just watching people come grabbing up along the lines of blocks of stuff that could be used to promote themselves and make wealth. Yeah,
thank you. No, thank you, brother. You know, brother Douglas has a point, and thank you. I think we had a little difficulty hearing you, but I think we got the gist of what you were saying. He echoes what a lot of people say. They say, "Well, hold on a second. You know, you gave up your right to vote. You know, when you committed that crime. You know, and so to some, there's danger in allowing folk. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that argument, because second chance, but for the grace of God, there go." All right, but he's saying there are a lot of folk out there saying, hey, well, hold on a second. Now, you know, when you committed that crime, you know, one of the things you should have realized was you weren't going to be able to vote. What do we say to that? What do we say to those people who are millions around this country?
Well, I think that you have to think about that says something about how the right to vote is somehow holy or something. That's almost like you're entering a temple with somebody else. So do we not want, then where do you stop? Somebody who's messing around on his wife?
You can't worship Jesus anymore because you think that. Right? Or Buddha or Allah.
It becomes,
because you made a mistake.
Right. And the other thing is the wrongful conviction rate in this state specifically is so bad that I think that would be hard to parse out.
Yeah, and Mr. Riley, I really wanted, I wanted to talk about that earlier. I think you just... The wrongful conviction rate, we're finding more and more every day about the hundreds of thousands of millions of people through time who've been victims of the system who never really made a mistake anyway. So that something was taken from them that never should have been taken. So talk about that. I think when you talk about restoring rights, given the fact that we know that we've incarcerated so many wrongly, especially with prosecutorial misconduct and what the system has done, it should be easier to restore people's rights.
And I think what you're getting at there, and also, you know, to address the caller a little bit, to tie those together, is, you know, we've built this imperfect system. And, you know, and maybe it worked in 1870
maybe.
For the people who designed it.
For them.
Right. And yeah. it just got bigger and bigger, and it was built on a pretty shaky foundation.
Right.
And so we have all these effects of incarcerations, and now we kind of go back and try to justify it with new language. And so we have to try to say that, you know, you've given up your right to vote. And it's like, wait a minute, when was that ever part of the exchange for a conviction and a punishment? No judge ever sentenced anyone to give up right to vote. And it's not a right if you can actually get it taken away so easily. And then it just becomes a privilege.
Well, we're gonna take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the whole foundation of America and this democracy being shaken. Because if Michelle Alexander's numbers are right, close to 7 million people who have lost citizenship, and a growing number if we continue down this path of mass incarceration in the prison industrial complex. We're going to come back and talk about how we make this right with Ms. Bruce Riley and, of course, Ms. Katie McDowell after the break.
WBOK, 1230 AM, The People's Station.
You are now listening to the Good Morning Show on WBOK 1230 AM.
We're back. Welcome back to the Good Morning Show. Oliver O.T. Thomas, the early bird. The entire WBOK listening audience, man. Great, powerful discussion. Katie Rector, editor, one of my favorite journalists of all time, especially covering the stuff that matters. And Mr. Bruce Riley, the deputy director of Vote, Voice of the Ex Offender. Katie, you know, it's kind of trendy now, you know, this prison reform conversation and rights back. But what I have noticed is that the trendiness in the conversations haven't really caught up with the public policies in many cases. Louisiana and southern states still dealing with mandatory minimums when folks are talking about getting away from mandatory minimums. There's still this push to punish when we've wasted billions of dollars. So talk about how at some point our elected officials and our policymakers got to catch up with the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, one of the easiest things to do would be to limit the multiple offender billing, right?
I mean, Mamia Bujamal's book, I mean, on Jailhouse Lawyer, where he talks about how they're damaging the democracy by overbilling people and dealing with false pleas. They're really killing our society like that.
Well, and I think right now in the Orleans Parish Courthouse, we see that tactic is used more than ever. I think it's used across the nation, but it's used really powerfully here, where you overcharge somebody, and then they plead to something less, but they're pleading to 7 years instead of life or something. 7 years for something that they probably shouldn't have gotten 7 years for initially.
I think we saw that in the first series of the first installment of Imprisoned, the story about the gentleman, right, who went there for one thing. He was innocent of that thing, so the system kept finding other things to punish him. How crazy is that, Mr. Riley? It's like, okay, we know we found out you didn't do that, but your body means money. We want to keep you here, so we got to find another charge for you.
Yeah, and you know the thing is, you know, our budgets follow our priorities at this point, and so, you know, you don't hear the prosecution complain that they're underfunded, mm-hmm. but you hear the public defender, you know, in a crisis, having to sue the state. The police become a unaccounted for investigatory system for the prosecutors.
Right.
They don't investigate for the defense attorneys. And then with things like the multi-bill and people being able to be punished like mm-hmm. harder and harder and harder mm-hmm. each time. I mean, you could steal, you know, a pack of cigarettes. And it's, you know, by the third time, it's going to face a life in prison.
Ms. Riley, I want to expound on what you said, because I use it in my talks. Everywhere I go around the country, when I talk about the system, I had a powerful conversation, Tracy Washington and I did, with CES 504 and a young man, Percy Marchand, when they talked about New Orleans. Both are successful today, but they talked about the challenges growing up here. And when I asked, to explain New Orleans to them, and it goes with what you just said, Mr. Riley, they said that, well, you know, growing up, it was tough. It is one of the most difficult places in America for a young black man to grow up. They said every time we needed money for parks and equipment, there was always a shortage. He said every time we looked for programs and after school and internship programs and training programs, it was always a funding issue. So anytime we needed something to help us in the intervention, it was a challenge for funding. He said, but anytime we made a mistake, there was always enough money to punish us. So there was never a question about funding to punish young black men, but there was always a challenge for the city and for government to come up with funding for things that could help or prevent them from being punished.
The after-school programs are so lacking in the city, I mm-hmm. think. You look at all those things. Plus, I mean, you know about the story about all those Sess was in one of those videos.
Yes.
That some of the kids who've done really well, and I say kids because I'm older now.
Right.
But who have done really well with their art and
yes.
gotten out of it.
Yes.
Now they're rapping and their lyrics are being used
against them
in court.
Absolutely. So what you say, so the system conveniently always finds a way. It's very easy for the system to come up with a way to punish than help. We can go to the lines right now. Big Al Mims, man. Peace, man. You're on with Katie Reckdahl and Bruce Riley.
Hey, your guess is more to knowledge, but I want to say this, Oliver. First of all, you did a great job at Franklin Avenue under some tough situations, but that's when the cream rises to the top. And I'm going to say this. I served two terms on the parole board from mm-hmm. 2005 to 12, Bobby Jenner's first mm-hmm. term, and they had people in jail that looked like me that wouldn't kill a fly. and they was in jail for little things, stupid
right.
things.
Right.
And they had 9-grade educations, and I asked them. They had good records, no write-ups, but what kind of good job skills you got
mm-hmm.
picking up trash on a highway? And I blame the system for that, because you can't lock a guy up, a woman up, for 4 or 5 years, and then when they get out, you put them back in the community, mm-hmm. they ain't got no skills. You setting them up to fail.
Right.
And last but not least, Harry Connick should be in jail. Harry Connick put so many people in jail and had things set up. He had a jury that would that's going to listen to him,
mm-hmm.
and he had 100% conviction rate.
Right.
How you do this?
Right.
You have a great day.
Good point, Mr. Riley. As an ex-offender, someone who's challenged and fought the system, talk about how frustrating it is, especially for guys who've committed their lives to justice. And what I tell folk all the time, okay, a lot of the ex-offenders I work with, you're talking about straight-laced people who follow, there's no gray area for them. They talking about conservative, you know, you're talking about being tough on crime. They actually have very little patience for people who've gotten another chance who make mistakes. So I don't know very many people who are more conservative than a lot of ex-offenders, especially mm-hmm. ones who live right. But Mr. Riley, talk about when you saw so much injustice, especially all the people who were wrongly convicted. You know, it's got to frustrate you that in many cases the public can time and time again hear about wrongful convictions and kind of turn a deaf ear mm-hmm. to it.
Yeah, but, I mean, we frame them as anomalies. Right, we don't see them as a normal thing.
It's not anomalies right? anymore. It's
and only the few percent of people who are actually going to trial are going to have a chance later on mm-hmm. to challenge the wrongful conviction. As Katie was saying, you have people, they'll say plead to 7 years. They have no faith in the system, and so they're just going to take the 7 years or you know whatever the number is rather than the life they're accused of, and they feel they'll get the conviction. I didn't do it, but I'm going to lose this trial. Mm-hmm. They're up again, you know, I've got this lying witness or whatever the case may be, and I'm going to go down. So I'll take the 2 years and go home someday. And we have to not look at them anomalies, and we have to consider, you know, a teacher once told me, you know, if one kid's failing, it's the kid's fault.
Right.
If the whole class is failing, it's the teacher's fault. And so we have a system where as the caller was saying, you know, you see people where the system's failing people for job skills, and I want people to see that we do have various programs, right? We have a program for employment readiness, but it's called CAGES. We have a program for homelessness, but it's called CAGES. We have a program for substance abuse, but it's called CAGES. We have this very highly funded program. It's a terrible program with bad results, and long term, it's a total failure and intergenerational, but we do have a program.
Katie, historians and intellectuals and academics who look at this movement about restoring rights, you know, basically say it could be an effort to restore our democracy and our humanity that we're actually jeopardizing our humanity. When you know, you talked about overbilling people. I mentioned Mumia's Abu-Jamal's book,
right.
Jailhouse Lawyer, where he highlights perfectly the damage that has been done to democracy, the tyranny of good intentions. That book that talks about where we're headed if we continue down this path. Do our policymakers, do our district attorneys and U.S. attorneys and judges, do they get it?
Well, I think that there's a lack of mercy, and there's this weird sort of dichotomy between trying to say we feel good about
tough on crime.
Right, the tough on crime thing. But I think, you know, Brother Al Mims was on the parole board. I can't imagine yes. how frustrating that would be, because you know that there are people that you see in the community mm-hmm. that have committed violent crimes, that are out, like you said, living such a straight life,
yeah.
right? And you know that it's possible, mm-hmm. especially if they get the skills to do something mm-hmm. else, right? And so I think that to solve the problem of mass incarceration, part of what it will take is understanding that that people can do something wrong and do better afterwards. I don't understand why that's such a mystery. I mean, we all screw up, right?
You know, Calvin Duncan has dedicated his life wrongly, you know, time and time again, Mr. Riley, we're meeting wrongly convicted people who many are coming back to challenge the system. I think people have no idea just how many men and women can actually educate themselves in prison, become experts, very proficient in what they do. But they've opted to go back and begin to challenge the system. We see more ex-offenders doing that.
And I think it, you know, if with any group of folks, you're going to have, you know, you get on a basketball team and you got guys that pass, you got guys that want to bring everyone mm-hmm. together, be like a coach. And that's just maybe something of our makeup. And you go into prison system and you're going to have guys and women who see like the leadership that's needed. Mm-hmm. They want to help other people. And, you know, they're just made up, and it's no different in prison than out in the community. And I think, you know, to get over this mass incarceration, and as Katie's saying, this lack of mercy, you know, we really have to see folks, whether they're inside or formerly inside, as one community, as our neighbors, as our brothers and sisters and our cousins and our parents, the people who mm-hmm. who fix our car, who cook our food, who do our law, whatever it is that they do for our community. And, you know, if we just had this approach of, and sometimes we see the hypocrisy on the news, we'll see the person who got maybe the type of sentence that a judge would sentence their own family member to.
Right.
And maybe it's because they look like the judge. And then we see the sentence that you might sentence like an other to. And so it's this othering that we've created, particularly black people in America, this othering that allows folks to get this merciless sentence.
Katie, I want to get right to that because you mentioned race in the beginning when we started this segment. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded of a conversation that I had with a judge, and I won't say any name, who was extremely frustrated because they're frustrated that, and what she basically said was that she's tired of assistant district attorneys recommending one thing for whites and another thing for African Americans. She was just fed up the last time, and she said no. I just had a case for a young black man who you guys wanted to punish, and then now you're asking me to consider a lesser offense. That happens. It's real.
Right. Well, I lived on the corner of Rampart and Esplanade on the mm-hmm. second floor, and just watching traffic stops, you know who gets stopped and who doesn't. I don't need a report, NLPD report, because I see it. I used to see it every day, right? And so those kinds of things, it goes from traffic stops mm-hmm. all the way up to wrongful convictions for murder. Right?
But Bruce Riley, do you think we get it, or is it just is this whole conversation around ex-offenders, is this the flavor of the month now? The fact that we're doing like Ralph Nader said, you know, we're pretty much bankrupting states and local communities with criminal justice system, that they have to? Or is it just talk?
I don't think it's just talk. I mean, it's probably a terrible analogy, but it's one that works for me, you know, from one book. A man said, capitalism builds its own gravediggers. And so, you know, the mass incarceration builds its own gravediggers as well. I mean, after a while, you look around and maybe you're the last one not convicted. And you're like, oh, wait, now I'm the minority.
Katie, in one of my speeches about mass incarceration, I talked about, and I used Michelle Alexander's book as an example, and I think it's a perfect segue, is that if it's 7 million people on probation, parole, and in prison today, and we continue these practices, what happens when it's 14 million? And then what happens when it's 21 million? Taxation without representation. History says that's a dangerous place to be. Unless we do a 180, are we headed that way?
Well, I think you see some movements in reform. I mean, Louisiana's prison count just went up again this year, last year, right? So that's disappointing. It's been going the opposite way nationally. And, of course, Obama has been putting the mm-hmm. federal prison rate down. But it seems like we haven't really decided on the sentencing part right. that will keep it down. Instead we're letting people out, or we're doing but if you're letting people out, sometimes you're letting them out on parole for 30 years, and then they still can't vote, right? So, and then they're still not a full
those
citizen.
Those long probation and parole periods that have not been centerpiece in the discussion, but at some point it has to be too. You know, you got people on probation and parole for all. I mean, like, huh? Especially if they've proven that it can be reduced or should be reduced, Mr. Riley.
Yeah, and the thing with, you know, a lot of the alternatives that people are finding are things where you're basically just setting up to expand the system. Like, for instance, we're gonna create an old folks home for
you got one probation officer with 200-300 people.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
And, the big problem is when you look at the rise of mass incarceration, you know, you look at the decline of manufacturing, mm-hmm. and you look at, another famous quote by an industrialist, which was, you know, I can pay half the working class to kill the other half. Now, that's a little extreme, but we have, you know, half the working class incarcerating the other half.
Wow, we're about to end this segment. So the last question I ask both of you, does this say something about our humanity or lack thereof?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it goes right to our humanity. And the fact that we can maybe only talk about wrongful convictions as places where we need to have mercy or rehabilitation
right.
is a problem.
Katie, you agree?
I do. I think that we run into it too often with people who are neighbors, who have somebody in Angola that's trying to visit, somebody who they're trying to make phone calls to. Everybody suffers, I think.
Well, what you do for the least of thee, you do for mm-hmm. me. Matthew 25 and 35, hungry you fed me, thirsty I gave you a drink, sick and in prison, I visited you and comforted you. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Guys, thank y'all. Y'all,
nice.
y'all promise to come back?
I'll be back.
For
wow,
sure.
this is OT and the Early Bird. Katie Rechdahl, editor, journalist, Mr. Bruce Riley, deputy director of Vote. Voice of the Ex-Defender. I want to thank Deidre Johnson Burrell and Amanda Aiken on the school unification process and everybody who calls in ways and love y'all more than you know. I tried to wake y'all up. Guess what? The next brother is going to make sure you're conscious. The Conscious Hour with Chuck Perkins. He'll do it again.